Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride.
In this episode of For the Love of Conversation, Shannon and I talk with Aaron Velarde, founder and CEO of Vote Run Lead, the largest and most diverse women's campaign and leadership program in the country. Their mission is to educate diverse women to unleash their independent political power, seek public office, and transform American democracy. I've been talking with Shannon about female political representation on and off for a couple of years now. It's bothered me to no end. I'll read an article somewhere about the topic, and I'll go down a rabbit hole for a couple hours and emerge more frustrated than when I started. I often marvel at how women have been able to deal with this frustration for, well, literally forever. How are the numbers this skewed in the United States? We've actually lost some ground since we talked to Aaron a couple weeks ago. We're now 104th in the world in female representation. It's crazy. How is it that the best leaders I know are all women, and we've got over 75% men in positions of political power? I had grave reservations for Hillary Clinton's election long before she lost it. And for me, it wasn't even so much about her. I didn't think she'd lose. I don't think anybody thought she'd lose. I was more worried about what would happen if she did win. I imagined the backlash that would be unleashed upon her and women over her time in office. You could feel the onslaught coming. And I really worried what that would do to young women watching and how it might derail women from even venturing into politics and leadership. I guess we'll never know. And perhaps, as Aaron talks about here, Donald Trump's election was probably the best thing that's ever happened to women entering politics. I've chickened out from writing about this topic for a long time. You know, who wants to hear from another guy on this? I thought, do we need another mansplainer giving his take? But watching politicians this last year has made something all too clear. Silence is the worst form of compliance. So I reached out to Aaron to talk about Vote Run Lead and set up our interview in their offices in Harlem, which is this wonderful hive of diverse, largely millennial activity. Watching it all made Shannon and I so happy. We just kind of sat there and took it all in. But at the same time, it made us feel all of our 40 plus years. It also made me glad that even though I thought about telling Shannon, you know, you should go, this is a better topic for you to do, I didn't. Because it's not. It's what all of us need to get off our ass and get behind. I think like a lot of men, I'm still not sure what exactly to do sometimes. Donate, sponsor, march, campaign, write, all of it, I guess. Organizations like Vote Run Lead, as you'll hear in this conversation, have things well in hand without me and without us. But maybe first, the first thing, is to just say, I'm rooting for you. I'm rooting for all of us.
I think in the United States, we see ourselves as very forward-thinking, as cutting edge, as the birthplace of the feminist movement. So when we take a hard look at gender equity, at the roles we're still asking women to play, the double duty we're still expecting of women, we don't want to talk about the huge disparities. And the biggest one, I think, is political power. That's the place that gets to write the laws, that gets to set the regulation, that gets to put policy in place that then affects the culture, affects how businesses must run, potentially even passing the ERA. These things were just not top of mind because we already thought we were really great. So telling folks that we are behind 99 other countries in the world around democracy, they don't believe it. The expectation is we're somehow number one, that USA, USA, USA. And so really the facts do help. They illuminate that we've been stuck at 23% women in government for about two decades. You know, the year of the woman was 1992. That's a long time ago. Those kids are graduating high school. So really having that tough conversation, but giving folks the numbers, because they see a handful of blue suits or red suits, you know, at the inauguration or in Congress, and they think, okay, that's enough. And so the perception doesn't actually match up with the numbers. And honestly, I think the political parties have been quite lazy about actively recruiting women because they have a case-by-case, need-to-win-an-election incentive. And so it always bucks up against having a diversity of gender, diversity of people of color. They're not going to take long-term political risks when they're going for short-term gain. So it goes against their incentive structure to really look and recruit women. That's all changed after the 2016 election, of course, and they're playing catch up, which is a good thing. But we still have that, the systemic stuff that the party structures are really keeping women out of power.
Can we dive into like that since that 16 election and what this year has been like for you guys?
Yeah.
It's got to be kind of mind blowing, I would imagine.
Sure. So following the 2016 election, we had a couple of really fantastic local wins, though. I was probably 40 feet from Hillary Clinton's podium at the Javits Center, receiving text messages from my family saying, "We see you on television, do not cry." So I'm, you know, doing this while we're all watching the returns come in. So many mothers and daughters of my colleagues were around me, consoling 16 and 17 year old women that had no idea that this was gonna happen and just couldn't believe that this was the America they lived in. So that was tough. The next day, of course, we got some really fantastic news with folks like now State Representative Ilhan Omar, who is the first Somali American elected, refugee, you know, went through the Vote Relief program several times. We're so thrilled at some of those local wins across the country, more women of color in the Senate, some good highlights. But that was it. The inbox was through the roof. We did our first online webinar called This Is How You Run for Office. We actually brought Ilhan. We ended up doing three of them. We had, I think, over 3,000 RSVPs for those three. We used to get 50, 70, 20 women coming to the web classes. And so to watch 1,500 women, 1,100 women, 900 women signing up at a time, we knew that we had to quickly figure out how do we deliver political education and civic literacy. And in 2017, we trained 9,700 women online and in person, three times as many as any past year, more than any other organization. I think we all put on 15 pounds and, you know, just were exhausted. we were in 14 different cities around the country. We kicked off with a partner training farmers to run for office and getting into more rural communities. And we saw about 70% of our alumni actually win their races over the course of 2017. Now, you know, the 9,700 turned into about 50, 60 women actually running. So you have to have that volume of women who are politically educated and saying yes to their own political ambition, because the ratio that they're going to run in this election cycle, the likelihood that they're going to win that election cycle, you know, that the dwindling of numbers, it goes from, you know, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 500, 1 in 20. So it's really critical, and Vote Run Lead is really going for volume. We're going for those 520,000 seats. You know, I think 536 or 537 are federal. So what are we going to do with the other 500,000 and change? And that's our focal point in thinking about what does transformative numbers really look like. If every woman got asked to run for office, we could see in two election cycles, you know, an increase of 10 or 15 or 20% women in local government across the country.
I wanted to just kind of step back a little bit and start more at the foundation of you, just to kind of help ground us in. I mean, there's been a lot that I've been able to find about your sort of professional journey, but your personal journey as are there hints of your in your childhood, mm-hmm, in your mm-hmm. family, in your cultural sure. background yeah. that hinted at this empowerment and this leadership?
Sure, sure. So my sister's about 9 years older than I am and was the first in our family to go to college. We're of five kids. Mm-hmm. So she went off to Douglas, which is the women's college at Rutgers, and had me subscribe to Ms. Magazine as a seventh grader. So she was getting her, you know, Women's Studies 101 and really bringing it home. She was always an activist. My mom was sort of quietly a feminist. I don't think she knew it in the sense of she felt like the world took care of boys, and so she had to put the extra effort into my sister and I to, you know, make sure that we had those leadership opportunities, that we were playing sports. You know, my sister slept in her Girl Scout uniform, and I played every sport under the sun, you know, sort of Title IX effect. And so I would read Ms. Magazine. It was probably a little above my head, some of it, but really began to see the world, the way that women were treated poorly around the world, and understood the fortunate nature of being born in the United States, for sure. That was glaringly obvious. But definitely had this, you know, if women were in charge, a lot of these things would be taken care of. So I had that understanding. And in the seventh grade, there was, it was the holiday season at my public school. So we had coming up on the seasonal break. And I'm in the back of the bus, you know, cool kid sitting in the back of the bus, turn into my school to see a sign that said Goodwill Towards Men, that was the seasonal holiday sign. So I'm, you know, plastered against the back of the bus with, you know, Ms. Magazine in my backpack, like, no, I will not stand for this. Went home that night, got my loose leaf paper together, called my sister, started a petition, had, you know, hundreds of kids sign it the next morning on the bus all day, dropped it off at the principal's office, and myself and a handful of the kids that were the first to sign, which, you know, we're the back of the bus kids, which maybe is not your potential, like, ideal student to go in and protest with. And as we walked into the principal's office, he had the dictionary open, and he pointed at the word man to say that this was, you know, all-encompassing and could mean human. And before I could get my, you know, speech and spiel out, the other students that I was with were just adamant, boys and girls, that didn't matter, that wasn't reflective. I couldn't even tell you what they were saying, because it was a moment in my life that I very much remember feeling very powerful in creating a platform for others to have a voice, to that sort of positive shock of seeing other people pick up your mantle, and that we were clearly winning this argument. You know, later that afternoon, we got to change the sign to something like, Happy Holidays to Each and Every One of Us, or, you know, very generic, very all-encompassing, very inclusive. You know, Goodwill Towards Men is also a Catholic or Christian religious. This was a public school, so I felt really proud of that. And I was then elected to class president in the eighth grade, and no one ran against me in high school. So that sort of political leadership bug was, you know, had.
You know, and then you carried on to the White House Project mm-hmm. right sure. after. Right. And do you want to talk about, can you just talk sure, through sure, sure. Yeah. that, yeah. the journey there? Mm-hmm.
My time at the White House Project was a result of a good internship. I was an intern for them this summer. I was an intern for them my senior year, actually, and there were just a handful of women's leadership organizations in the country. In fact, I think one of the only other ones that was also in the region was Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers. It was a little bit too far of a commute. I was an undergraduate student at NYU, and I was very fortunate to have the White House Project in my own backyard. And so was able to serve as an intern, got hired immediately after college. The founder of the White House Project, Marie Wilson, was also the president of the Ms. Foundation at the time, and so she came over full time. The resources increased at the White House Project, and I actually got to start Vote Run Lead there in 2004 with another young woman. And we traveled all around the country. I think I'd been on a plane twice before traveling with Marie, who, you know, kept three outfits in a backpack. I never checked luggage again after that first trip. And so we went and crisscrossed the country, and we brought the Shirley Chisholm film, Unbought and Unbossed, with us. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of an education for myself as well. I knew of her, I didn't know the deep history there. I didn't know the parallels to the 2004 election. Carol Moseley Braun was running at the time. That you know, she was running for delegates in 1972. She knew she wasn't going to win the presidency, but she was running for political capital. And we were doing get out the vote efforts, telling women, we're going to come back and train you to run for office next year. Mm. Many of them looked at us side eye, you know, like, I'm going to run for office. You think I can do this? And so it really was having that cultural moment, getting folks excited about a past role model, someone who had broken barriers prior, and then saying, we actually think you're the right person to be in government. We're going to teach you how. We're going to demystify the process. And one of the biggest things we had to talk about for many years was the impact you could have in government, because women opted to be entrepreneurs. You know, at the same time, we saw a rise of women in small businesses and entrepreneurship. They opted to start their own nonprofits. They didn't actually see or value government as a place where they could get things done. So there was a lot of convincing, bringing in local electeds to say, not how hard it is. You know, we know all those stories. There are a lot of parallels with other industries, but what is the thing you are most proud of that you could only do as a public servant, that you could not do as a private citizen, and really helping women to see government as a high impact place.
Which is critical to our democracy, you know, which I think speaks to, you know, increasing representation at the core fundamental level of our democracy. I want to talk about your, since you brought up your mentors, I was going to talk about it a little later, but I really want to dig into that a little bit, because it feels like those women had a really profound influence on you. And they, you know, another thing we want to get into later on with you is kind of the long arc of the feminist movement and how this moment plays into that. And I think about, you know, you've had decades at this, and then they've had an even longer trajectory. Could you talk specifically about your relationship with them, what that was like? I know you talked about Marie and Barbara Lee, too. Like, there's been a couple people that have read in your background. And anyone else, like, kind of, like, help us get behind and inside what was really, what happened transformatively in those relationships.
So I consider Marie Wilson my political mother. You know, I got to work with her for almost 9 years, and it wasn't a traditional mentor-mentee relationship. It was jump in, share your ideas, learn by osmosis, trial and error, I'm going to trust you. She always rewarded young people who were willing to put their ideas forward. She always rewarded young people's perspective. She also rewarded us financially. You know, she was keeping us making sure that we had, you know, a living wage to live in New York City at a nonprofit level. And if we were going to be the VP, we were going to get a VP salary. And so really had a really holistic way of really taking care of her employees. And over the years, really just introducing me to other women around the country who were, you know, some of these women helped to start the movement of women presidents of colleges and universities. So the large number of women you see who became women presidents in the 80s and 90s. So looking at other models to say, look, we can get this leadership model done. And one of her most brilliant ideas was connecting with local women's funds and foundations across the country. So the Women's Foundation of Minnesota has an amazing executive director, Lee Roper Batker. The New York Women's Foundation here, Anna Oliveira, the Colorado Women's Foundation, where these networks, essentially, these were grant-making institutions that had access to local grantees who were doing community organizing, welfare building, domestic violence shelters, you know, taking care of the community, and yet were, you know, lobbying on the Capitol, but getting their legislation written away the next year by, you know, often conservative or majority male legislators. So those women were able to take risks. So people like Anna and Lee and these foundations to say, we're going to partner up with Vote Run Lead, and we're going to make this possible. And in those states is actually where you see the largest number of women that we've helped to elect into public office. So I think some of those women taking the risk in politics, because none of the philanthropic and grant-making institutions were interested in politics. Women's economic empowerment was all the rage, you know, making sure that women had access to small business loans and but not necessarily women's political leadership, and they were willing to make some of those connections. Now my team, I very much got peer mentorship. I probably didn't know what that was while I was going through it, but the women that you see as co-founders of Vote Run Lead, Rhonda Briggins and Liz Johnson, Shannon Garrett, those women were once my employees. though they used to call me baby boss because they're all 10, 15, maybe 20 years older than I am. But they were the field directors in their respective states. And so we're able to provide the sort of New York City hub with the, what was locally happening. Their input was invaluable. They helped me get through management issues. You know, they helped me coach other members of my team inside the New York office. They taught me what organizing was. They taught me what it meant to really not only hit diversity goals, but to build that diversity strategically within the organization, not as a tactical thing that was nice, but as a must-have in building women's leadership. Mm-hmm. So those women very much served for me as peer mentors and as coaches in a two-way relationship.
Mm-hmm. How does that play into your training model? Mm-hmm. Or does it? You know, I don't want to assume, but I would imagine it must, right? Like how mentorship comes into the Vote Run Lead training model, and maybe even how your training model has shifted from 2004 sure. to
yeah.
now.
Absolutely.
It must have shifted
absolutely.
Dramatically.
Yeah. Back in the 2000s, when all of us were flying around the country training women to run, we almost always on every event on the evaluation got a handful of women saying, "That is such a wonderful team you have. Several of you are in front of the room. You aren't interrupting each other. You are, you know, additive in the way that you're talking. You pull each other's expertise in." So I think the way we produced the events, and they were productions, you know, was very much a collegial shared leadership model in front of the room where we passed the mic to one another. It was not, "This is my moment, this is my speech." It was also when women would come up to us, we would say, "Okay, the best person for you to talk to is..." So the feedback we got was that this is an example of shared leadership. And I think also the women that we would bring in as panelists felt the same way as well. So they didn't feel like they had one point of contact within the organization. They really could, you know, before we would even get there, people would hug us as they arrived. They hadn't met us yet in person. And I think just that TLC that we were providing in making sure that scholarships were available for low-income women, childcare was available for moms, travel for rural women, and people felt really valued walking in. And I think that's a reflection of the team that we had. And all of us would travel to each other's respective conferences. So the curriculum was built by those women. Okay. And it was built in a really loving way. We used to kid about this one woman, Catherine Gray, is a documentary filmmaker. And she helped to craft our communications training, which we would laugh and say she was using love mittens, because by the end of the session, somebody had started here and was terrible, and all of a sudden was having this authentic storytelling where their body language is strong, they're not looking at their notes, and you know, even the woman herself couldn't believe that she had come that far. And she, you know, that we still use that love mitten strategy to this day. And then everybody adopts sort of the best of everyone else's curriculum, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of shared teaching and co-teaching. Mm-hmm. The 2016 election, though, really, we did have to update the curriculum because we had to account for the tens of thousands of women that had never considered public life. So the curriculum now is called Run As You Are, mm-hmm. which very much comes from our days at the White House Project, that you have all the skills, you have the talent that's necessary to run. We can teach you how to speak, we can teach you how to fundraise, you know, those skills are teachable. You have that, if you're stepping up to run, you have that thing, you have that fire in your belly that's a necessary component of public life. But we did have to assess what was coming at us, which was a very low amount of civic literacy, that mm-hmm. folks didn't know what a county commissioner does. They didn't know the requirements of being in the city council. Would I have to move to the Capitol if I was a state legislature? How much do these jobs make? What's a day in the life of a school board member like? You know, can I go to the grocery store in my pajamas anymore? You know, questions both about the function of government, what are the requirements of government? Not necessarily can I do this? This, what had completely changed after 2016 is women raising their hand and going, "Okay, I'll run for office." "Okay, what office would you like to run for?" "I don't know." So we had to update the "what office should I run for" curriculum. We created something called the 90-Day Challenge, which is 30 actions in 90 days that helps women accelerate their political capital, build networks within their community, start to share with folks that they have political ambition, get networked within their party, and actually determine what might be the best level of office and kind of office for them. So really just looking at how can we quickly raise the civic literacy of this group? How can we also help them quickly build political capital? Mm-hmm. And so the Run As You Are curriculum both takes the best from our gendered and diverse leadership at the White House Project and all of the nimbleness and use of technology and iterativeness that we have with Vote Run Lead now.
And so I'm hearing you say that it's not as much of an issue where women have the confidence gap in terms of their. You've really seen that shift in the past few years with what's happened in the country?
The best thing about Donald Trump getting elected is that they saw someone with no political or military experience and said, heck, I can be on the city council.
Okay.
There's still some confidence issues. You know, we still have to do some of the mindset work, but the risk and the is it worth it has completely changed. Mm-hmm. Where all these reasons for not running seem like 30 pounds on this side, all of a sudden that scale is I have to do this. If I don't, the weight of the world is on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. So that, or the weight of the community, or the missed opportunity of I could do that job better. That's the thing that has really switched. I could get into government. I don't like my garbage pickup. I don't like the brown grass at my kid's school, or that ketchup is a fruit or a vegetable. I'm not liking that the public parks are deteriorating. I see an immigrant community coming into my community, and I don't like how the police are going specifically after them. My taxes are way too high for the services that I'm getting. I mean, you name the issue, and women are motivated by it. And there is the underlying current that the expectation in 2018 and 2017 and 2016 that a woman still can't be president hit very hard for different generations of women. And it showed up very differently in generations of women. So older women were like, I've been fighting for this, the same, I thought this was our time, even if they didn't love Hillary Clinton, and many of them didn't, they recognized in their careers that they had been passed over for jobs by a less qualified man, that, there had been times in their career where they knew they were the better person and they didn't get it. For younger women, they had no idea that this was possible, that the assumption was that she was going to win, even though they were Bernie girls, So it wasn't necessarily that they were all gung-ho about her, but that this was the direction our country was going in, that feminist progress was becoming normalized. And it was a real awakening that in pockets of the country and in different communities, we're not all, holding hands in kumbaya. There's still a lot of work to do.
Right. Yeah. Mm. God, what a horrible segue, but it's all right.
Yeah, no.
how are you engaging men? Like, what are the conversations around that? My constituency, right? Speak for them for a moment.
Speaking for all men.
Exactly.
There's such a stigma around saying, why are there not more women leaders? Right? And I know a lot of guys feel it fervently, but you don't hear it. Of course you do in pockets, but you know what I'm saying? By and large. So. Yeah. How have you guys handled that? Or is it something that we'll deal with that later? We've got more pressing issues right now.
I think following the presidential election, it was very cool for men to say, we need more women.
Yeah.
Where it got tricky was all of this Me Too stuff.
Yeah.
It's gotten a lot trickier. So I also find a generational shift there where older men feel, I saw their reaction being, oh, you can't even shake a woman's hand anymore, right? Going to this extreme ridiculousness that their, orbit was somehow being cracked. Younger men were saying things like, I had no idea that the ignorance was so high about women in the workplace that they were almost apologetic on behalf of all men. I am seeing an increase of men say, I'm feminist, in feminist circles, in places where it's okay to say that, right? So I'll take that. We're moving that way. I heard my husband on the telephone say he was a feminist, and I was like, what? of course. I assumed, but identifying with that word is still tricky in this country, though it shouldn't be. But so I do find that we're moving in the right direction with men. Their intention is good. They don't know or have the tools about how to help dismantle it. Some of our biggest donors, though, following the election in last year, have been men coming in and saying, oh my God, women are better as a gender in government. Why aren't there more of you? Here's some money. Right. So we're happy to take that. Mm-hmm. We haven't been having those tough conversations, partly because we've never seen this many women run and we have our hands full. But of the groups that I know are doing it, they are helping men understand the larger ecosystem that allows this behavior to occur, that diminishes women's ambitions for political office, that when you don't see yourself repeatedly in positions of power, you have to have other pathways to get there or additional support and, you know, not just mentorship, but sponsorship in which you're pushing that woman forward. So helping them to understand that larger ecosystem. Sponsorship was a big thing that was taken from the private sector, which I thought could have worked better in politics, where you're not just mentoring someone and having those conversations saying, okay, let me give you some tips. You're using your own capital inside the company or inside the political party to say, no, this is the next one. Now, the Pence rule, where you can't have one-on-one meetings with women, has really hurt that. I think there are some men in corporate America who are afraid of, you know, having their things being misconstrued, right? Especially with younger women and older men. So we have to break through some of that.
Yeah. That's so challenging too.
It's so, you know, yeah. And we're like, get out of the way. There's this moment right now where there's so many of us coming forward that it's like, yes, I'm so glad you want to be on board, but God, I don't have time to help educate you. You know, like, go read a book and call me afterwards.
That would be my sense. I mean, literally, that would be my sense, you know, because I don't think I would handle it the same way.
Yeah. Huh. Though, you know, I am seeing, the one area that I think Vote Run Lead could help is, you know, helping some of the male campaign managers really think through, you cannot run a woman candidate the same way you're thinking of running a male candidate. And right now, for the short window, there's an advantage to this outsider status. So packaging her up in the same way is not going to work. Mm-hmm. And sort of getting, we're trying to get that message out there because the majority of campaign managers and political staff are, and high-level political staff are male.
And it's one of the reasons that Tammy Duckworth's emergence has been so fascinating to me, right? Is like how she was largely unknown by the general populace with her background, which is like incredible, right? And those moments of tweets are what, you know, suddenly tripled, you know, by multiples made her more known. Yeah. And it's kind of one of these things where it's like, wow, am I happy about this or am I not? Yeah. You know, like that's a tricky one for me. Yeah.
We do need these remarkable superstars who almost look supernatural, and you know, like a Tammy Duckworth who's overcome so much, who continues to break barriers. Now she'll be the first woman to give birth while a senator. You know, like an Ilhan Omar, right? Coming to this country as a refugee, going to political meetings with her grandfather as the translator, you know, how she got her, cut her political teeth. But what we do need behind them is the volume of women who are
stepping up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you can't, we've had the first and onlys for so long, and we've seen what's happened to them. Hillary Clinton is a perfect example of that. Mm. Everything about you will be dissected because you will be both a, you know, the sort of, the woman, right? And for all women, which is nobody should have that. So you'll, anything you do is like, oh, now women can do this. And she's also human. So these people will make mistakes. And it's important that yes, we need these barrier breakers, but behind them, there can't be two or three women. Behind them, there has to be dozens and dozens of women.
And is that a moment, is that how you see the evolution of the contrast from the Year of the Woman, 1992, that you referenced, to today? Is it that depth and that infrastructure? Or what do you see as, are we in a different moment now? Is once all of this fades away, you know?
The contrast between 1992 and 2018 is the numbers. Mm-hmm. So we doubled the women in the Senate. I think it was 3-6 or 4-8, you know, something very small in doubling. While we won't double, you know, 20-40, the number of women in the House, you know, the number of women who are running federally and for governorships is over 500. You know, Vote Run Lead tripling the number of trainees last year to almost 10,000. I do see the wave happening locally as well as federally in 2018. So women are saying, okay, A school board seat is good. I want to run for the state legislature. I see the state legislature is having more effect on what's happening right now. I don't care about federal level healthcare policy. You know, what I want to work on actually turns out to be at a county commission level. So the wave is also happening at a local level. What's different in 2018 is that this is also the year of the woman of color. Mm-hmm. The large numbers of African American women we're seeing, you know, in the Texas primaries in March, we're going to see, we saw two Latinas move forward. One of them will be the first Latina to represent Texas in Congress. You know, more immigrant women running, more first generation women running, young women running. We have a 20-year-old Muslim American woman running outside of Chicago. So that is the diversity of women who are running, the localness of those races. What is similar to 1992 is open seats. Women win when there are open seats. They're more likely to run when there are open seats. And I think 2018 will also be the year of the resignation. We have so many retirements, and I think on the local level, there are some, let's call them Me Too experiences of men in their backgrounds, and it's not worth it for them to stay anymore. They've been in these seats 30, 40, you know, 25 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. Their photograph is a photo from the 90s on their website. So I think they're looking, taking a hard look and saying, okay, there's a wave of new people coming. There's a different generation. There's a, you know, different set of values that are being pushed forth. I don't want it to come to light that 15 years ago I acted inappropriately in a different environment. So I think I'm going to step aside. And we would love this to be the year of the resignation. I mean, incumbency is being currently in that seat, being an incumbent, it has something like a 92% rate of reelection. So it is one of those things where the more open seats there are, the better it is for women.
I mean, speaking of kind of the power differential, I mean, you're like a student of power, really, in your political life and in this work. Like, what, you know, what you just, that scenario you just gave where, I mean, I would love for that to happen, you know, yes. That the man, the, you know, the, sort of the stalwart leader that's been in there for 30 years is going to hand it over because of the cultural pressure, yes. I mean, legitimately, but I guess I just want to tease out a little bit, like, what are the power dynamics at play, and mm-hmm. How have women changed in how they have to work in power? Is it a different kind of power, and what does that feel like mm-hmm. and look mm-hmm. like, and you know, I imagine a lot of this change is, the folks that are holding on to the power are not going to go quietly into the night. It's going to be a fight.
I think the power dynamic for women candidates is about navigating the insider-outsider status within the political party structure, which has the faucets turned on for resources for you or turned off, and that can be detrimental to your campaign. And then the outsider status with voters who are very much rewarding fresh voices, people who don't have a political background, people who don't carry that baggage. So we have tons of women running in Illinois. And you know, the Chicago political machine is probably one of the most well-known political machines in the country. Really, those conversations with women who are first-time candidates, they're navigating what it means to work with inside of the party structures and to get the anointing that's necessary to get the fundraising happening, to get the lists, to not have to spend more money on the kind of infrastructure that's already been built by the party, while also maintaining a, you know, a outsider, I'm going to clean up a little bit, I'm going to have that fresher perspective, I'm not bought in any way. So that's been a navigation on the candidate campaigning side. You know, once elected, we're seeing women put things on the agenda that no one else has even brought up in legislative policy, around pay equity, and making the case that from both a, you know, conservative and liberal side, that this is not only just and fair for women, that this is actually good for the economy when women have an extra 30 cents or 50 cents if you're Latina, you know, to pay for things to put back into the neighborhood. So really smart policies and thinking about how feminist policies can be attractive to both sides of the aisle. So the power structure is the introduction of new, not necessarily new ideas, but new ways of presenting those ideas. I also think that the accountability of young women in government, younger women in government, I'm thinking specifically about the Colorado State Legislature. Representative Faith Winter, who's also Vote Run Leeds National Training Director, recently had her sexual harasser expelled from the legislature. Mm-hmm. It's only the second time that's happened in history. The other state was Arizona. It's only the, I think it was 104 years or something like that since Colorado had expelled someone. It's a very serious process. He had been accused by 10 or 12 women. He had also been accused of retaliating against some of the men who had stood with Faith. Some of the men were fearful enough that they were wearing bulletproof vests at the Capitol. He's a former Marine and just did not feel, did feel like his threats were serious. And the process is fascinating. If Faith Winter wasn't a state representative, then he would have been able to go forward in front of his colleagues without any other voices of the victims being heard. But because she was there, mm-hmm. and because she had a formal position of power, she was able to represent not just herself, but the campaign managers and the lobbyists and the women staffers who had been affected by this and had also been harassed. And so the power dynamic between the women that are in power and those that are sort of outside the formal structure, there's a banding together there of saying, nope, I'm going to carry the mantle for you. Mm-hmm. And having the male allyship, because they spoke out, they had the male allyship. Men got up and also testified that he should be voted out. She had 22 votes going into it. I think it was 52-9 he got expelled.
Wow.
So it's rocking the boat in all the right ways.
Yeah.
And, we have long known this about women, though. We are more empathetic. We are better listeners. We are more likely to bring people together to work across the aisle. We're solution-oriented. We're more likely to bring more money home to our districts. We pass more bills. We co-sponsor more bills. We kind of work harder and smarter. There's less ego involved often. Mm-hmm. So, women get into government. Main reason is to get things done. Not so much for the rank or the power. So you're seeing that very much in motion. I don't think that will change, honestly. I think the reason that women are looking at government right now, again, is in order to get things done. I don't think they see it as a glamorous, amazing, $34,000 a year job. Right.
That's a good point.
So,
it's almost the absence of that now.
It's a really strong selling point. To touch on the diversity and the intersectionality that you've brought up a few times, and you're a Miss Girl, that these are the roots of the feminist movement that, we know from Gloria Steinem and everything. Clearly that's just built into the DNA of Vote Run Lead,
right.
And into all of the organizations it seems like that you're collaborating with. I guess I just wanted to sort of underline that and just talk about that a little bit, because it seems like your organization is leading that really effectively at a time when I think a lot of there's been a lot of criticism to the white feminists culturally for being behind the ball and trying to play catch up, or just really getting it wrong in so many different ways.
So I spoke a little bit about my co-founders, who it's a very diverse group racially and ethnically. It's a very diverse group representing the country. And again, that peer mentorship model. I remember walking into the first conference with Marie Wilson that we put on for Vote Run Lead in Minnesota, and she turned to me and said, oh my gosh, this looks like the UN. And it was the first ever conference we had done. Liz Johnson was the organizer, and she was at heart a community organizer. She had done the housing movement, a couple of other movement building efforts. She was the program officer at the Women's Foundation, and we scooped her up. And so the diversity of the grantees within the Women's Foundation community, and to go beyond the traditional lawyers and businesswomen who were running, and to go into immigrant communities and say, some of you have to run for office, to go to the environmentalist movement and say, some of you have to run for office, to go in front of the domestic violence survivors and say, some of you are going to have to run for office, and you're going to have to write this legislation if we want changes to domestic violence law. Some of those women knew that was the case. It wasn't 95% of the group saying, yes, I'll do this, but it was 5% of this group and 5% of this group. And the commitment to scholarshiping women and saying, what can we do to get you there? you know, we also used to have to trick folks a little bit and say, this is a fantastic leadership training. And then when they would come, it would be like, oh, by the way, you're all running for office. So in the early years, we were a little vague about how political it actually was. But it was called Go Run. So if you didn't, you know, the actual training itself. So if you didn't, but then all of a sudden this buzz started to happen about the kind of rooms that we were putting together. And once Liz had sort of set the bar around the new Americans that were in the room, she set the bar for the organization around cultural competency, around diversity, making sure younger women were there, making sure 77-year-old women were there. We still have work to do. I want to see more Asian American women running. I want to see more LGBTQ women running. We're seeing a wave of trans women running, which is awesome. There's a great program for Native American women running. They need to be running both on the reservation and off. So there's a lot of work to do. And there's personal work that, you know, as the head of the organization, I need to do. You know, you can only, you know, be so woke, right, as a white person. And so thinking about, like, what am I reading? What am I not reading? These young women of color are going to hold your feet to the fire. They don't care that you've been doing this work for 10 years or 15 years. And being open to that and being willing to, I think, make sure that we are creating the platform for the conversation, that we're not always the conversation leader. I think that's something that Vote Run Lead has done really well, is that we're creating the environment, bringing people together. You know, we're putting the head of, you know, Eileen Fisher's philanthropy next to a bunch of women in transitional housing who are part of, you know, getting out of violent homes. And next thing you know, Eileen Fisher's like sending a bunch of scarves and gloves and sweaters to the domestic violence shelter, you know, 4 weeks after the event. So putting those people at the same table. We don't put our funders at a reserved only table. We've moved to a model where everything is in round tables and there's a facilitator at every table. Facilitators come from the community. We do a little pre-training. And so everyone is getting to know each other. And now we've moved to a place where we're not only doing the diversity of groups, but making sure that then those groups have access to resources that are specific to African-American women, specific to Latinas, specific to rural communities. So at our most recent conference, it was a really both and, that you were in the big groups and the big plenaries and the workshops, and then there were these cohort models that you were able to opt in and out of. And it was, you know, it was a mistake on our part because all the white women were like, so, and we like missed that group when there could have been an opportunity for us to really say, oh, right, amazing white women who want to do good work and are willing to be, you know, sitting in some of these. So like we had, you know, a couple of bumbles with that. But really just trying to think like every single time we're doing this, what's the intentionality of, it's a production. It's not really a training. It's like it really is a production of saying, if I'm this person, what does my three-day experience look like? If I'm this person, what does my three-day experience look like? Mm-hmm. And we have beautiful alumni network that will just tell us right to our face what's good and what isn't. So we get some really candid feedback about, you know, I know what you're trying to do here, but maybe this time we can do this. I'd love seeing all the young women, but what about some of the older generations of women who had been around and doing this work? So it's just constantly keeping your ear to the ground, asking questions, being willing to listen. And sometimes it can't be perfect. You know, sometimes you just have to go with the thing knowing that you don't have the most diverse panel, or, you know, you have two cancellations last minute and now all of a sudden you have only Republicans on the stage. It's like, okay, we've got, you know, got to be thinking on our feet. But again, we, like I said, Liz really set the bar high. And once you do that, and once you feel the magic of a gathering like that, you're almost addicted to making like that microcosm of America and rooms all across the country.
What is it? Can you describe the magic? Like, what does it feel like for people who haven't experienced that?
We can't describe it. Just call it the magic all the time. You know, it really is about empathy. It's this place where, like, you know, women who have different viewpoints on an issue are having real dialogue and not raising their voices, and, you know, figuring out like how tax policy and small businesses and, you know, a $15 minimum wage can all work together. Not because we're nonpartisan, we're not telling people how to talk about taxes or how to talk about unions or how to talk about water. So they're coming there with their own experiences. They're highly validated as they come in. So that confidence boost is there. There really is something magical about just putting a bunch of women who have ambition in a room together to do good, not for the ego-driven, you know, we're all in competition with each other. We've had women running for the same seat at conferences, and they're hugging at the end. And they're committing to, you know, have a high bar campaign where they're not going to go low on each other. So it's sort of like it's the best of like all the things we think American democracy is.
Yeah. So many things I could finish with, but we got to finish. I wanted to kind of bring it back to the emotions of the story you told, your first moment of activism, I suppose we would call it, and particularly in light of what happened recently with Parkland. What were your emotions when you saw those kids, one, being listened to, and how powerful that was, and probably recalling how powerful it was for you to be listened to by your peers, mm-hmm. and two, not being listened to, and in fact shouted down, and how that principle sort of morphed from your life into a large segment of our society a couple of days after it happened?
I was slightly addicted to listening to the news coverage of these kids who were standing up and sharing a very traumatic event within hours and days of experiencing that traumatic event and turning that into activism and potential public policy. Because I was in awe of them. I think the next generation of young people in this country is like 5 times smarter than any, you know, 10 times smarter than me. You know, thinking about Emma Gonzalez and just like, when can I get you to run for office was one of my immediate things, right? Like, you need to be governor of Florida in 6 years, right? So what's the path that for us for you to get there? I love that the kids understood that the gender diversity had to be there. They went on all the Sunday shows of like 2 girls and 3 boys or 3 girls and 2 boys. They that stuff is really built into them. I love that their parents like let them lead and supported that, but let them have the podium. And it didn't feel like, okay, you need to be, you know, a poster child in the sense of we're putting you on the poster, but we're speaking for you. They didn't wait for the traditional infrastructure or a traditional institution to come and take them on. They used social media, which was fantastic. I was not surprised, I guess, sadly, by the conservative backlash of which, you know, people began to, I wouldn't even call conservative, it's sort of like the troll backlash, right? Mm-hmm. Because I know tons of conservatives that are like, yeah, we're okay with pushing the law to 21. We're okay with, you know, background checks for mental health. So there was a lot, I felt a lot of hope there. I felt a lot of frustration. I had that same kind of angry tears I think I had after the election, mm-hmm. where you're fed up. There's a level of disgust about how far we've let things go and the consequences being deadly. That this odd kind of trolling, you know, underbelly of the United States that, you know, says these kids are paid actors, you know, you are, again, you're disgusted by it. I honestly think it helped them, to be frank. I think it kept them in the spotlight. I think it will keep them in the spotlight. I think they will probably be the first set of people to get some positive gun policy passed in a decade, because they have nothing to lose. And that's both a powerful and sort of dangerous place to be. There's, you know, that's a political power that I think you can also see in the people that are running right now. There's nothing to lose. Like, things are not going at all, and not even in the direction that I wanted to go. They're getting pulled in a way that I'm not okay with, at a really visceral level. And so I think the kids really represent like a chord that's happening across the country where people are like, it's okay if I don't win this election. It's okay if I, have to take leave from my job or, you know, have this sort of economic hit on my family because I'm running for office or I don't graduate school on time. That's okay because there's this bigger thing happening and I have to push forward on it.
What I really love most about that conversation is that beautiful image Aaron painted about what a vote run lead room looks like. People engaging in dialogue instead of debate.
that image of two competing candidates embracing each other. Look, I know I'm naive, but what if, you know, what if? We hope you go check out VoteRunLead.org and read some of the amazing stories of the 30,000 women the organization will be training and readying for political office by 2020. That wave is coming. It's coming. We're so glad you're along for the ride.